Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton. And today, I'm joined by film and content specialist Cam Maitland and podcaster and film and comic book nerd Petula Neal. The perfect ensemble is hard to assemble. The scheduling alone seems like a nightmare. But for some reason, in 2010, someone yelled, "Assemble!" And although The Avengers was still 2 years away from release, it's a big year for action ensemble movies. Aside from our two movies today, Red and The Expendables, there is The Losers, which has a similar plot to The Expendables. An elite group goes into the jungle on a mission and stuff goes sideways with Zoe Saldana, Idris Elba, and Jeffrey Dean Morgan. There's even the A-Team movie starring Liam Neeson. With so many big personalities and so little movie runtime, Petula, what do you want to get out of one of these movies? What makes you stand up and cheer for these?
Adequate screen time for people who aren't the lead to have interactions. So,
yeah,
I don't know, not the Bechdel, but like other Del.
The buddy Del.
I like those moments.
Sure.
Yeah, I like the moments when the, hey, yeah, it's that person, actors get to interact and have a moment, because those are often sometimes the most entertaining, because we know what our leads are going to do when they cast people in these movies. They're doing what they're doing, maybe not always crawling through air ducts, but they're giving that energy for the other people that you see show up in these. It's always a moment of joy, like, oh, I forgot Brian Cox was in this. Let's let him cook for a minute. Yeah. Yeah.
I get what you mean. Like, for me, the 2000s gold standard of any of these kinds of movies is the original Ocean's 11. I think it is perfect the way they introduced all the characters. The cast is amazing, of like these generational actors. Like, sure, who brought in Elliot Gould with the giant glasses? Well done, my friends. Well, later on, we're going to find out who did bring Elliot Gould, because he's responsible for one of our other movies today. But like, that movie is perfect for knowing when to leave Danny Ocean in the stupid romantic plot line that they just needed for Julia Roberts and Andy Garcia off to the side, right? You want to watch them do the heist. You want to watch everybody do their thing in their different parts, right? That's kind of the fun part of it.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, yeah, you're right. It's like the whole is better than the sum of the parts. And usually you're right too, that the lead is not worth much of anything. They have a boring plot. And I think both of these movies as well are like pretty good comedic showcases for action people and serious actors sometimes in ways that are pretty charming. And I think that's kind of a through line. There's not many dead serious group action films, because that's not a dynamic. Who needs that? Who needs interpersonal drama, really, right? I don't know.
Well, when we get into The Expendables, Stallone wanted to make his own version of Peckinpah's The Wild Bunch, which, I mean, Peckinpah is like kind of I can see it. I want to say I can see it.
Sure.
But also Peckinpah's sense of humor is present,
yeah,
but god damn, it is like bone dry amidst all like the vast amounts of violence.
Sure. But I was going to say, it's still a pretty funny movie, The Wild Bunch, until they all, the spoiler ending. But I think that they're having fun. they have fun on the way. It's what makes them wild.
Do either of you pay attention to any like the drama that happens on set? Like, does that affect how you watch the movie, or do you just kind of go into the movie watching these characters as characters, as opposed to who the actors are that are playing them and however they would interact?
I try to avoid it.
Does that
I'd
make sense?
In 2010, I was much less aware.
Yeah.
Thanks to the internet, you not yet being the informative and entertaining hellscape that it is currently. We didn't have as much behind the scenes, like, say, for example, Fury Road. Maybe they didn't all get along great. So it was easier to go in with a certain amount of naivete and assume that everybody had as much fun as it looks like they're having in the knife throwing scene in the bumper, for instance.
Yeah, I mean, unless it's like a weird I remember, well, we'll get into the Expendables, like some of the like, whoa, these guys together for the first time, but other than that, yeah, I mean, I always think of like the recent various Fast and Furious dramas too, where it's like, now those are almost hard to watch because you're like, these guys hate each other, and like, you know that if The Rock ever shows up again, you're like, wow, they either paid him a lot or
I was just thinking, is that Vin Diesel apologized to everyone. And there's, I mean, when you call someone a candy ass, there's no going back from that.
No. So yeah, that you're right. It is. It's, even though 2010, it's not like there was no internet. It was definitely a different kind of internet. And it was still, I guess, the, sorry to bring it up, like, Ain't It Cool News era of like, so you would get very controlled set leaks that were basically like PR in the form of news. So it'd be like, Jet Li loves Stallone, you know, it would all be very
and
pleasant.
And the fan areas were so sweet and well-meaning, like the OneRing.net, remember that? It was just love on love on love.
Yeah.
Yeah, doesn't happen anymore. Mm-hmm.
Yes. No, now that we have oral histories, I love them, they're great for my job, but yeah. Yeah. It's everyone's job, I guess. Back in the day, we used to just think
Also,
pleasant.
Now people either are like doing some sort of like vacation with their best friends in an ensemble film, like the Grown Ups movies. I mean, a perfect example of this, of course, is the multiple Expendables franchises. Who do we want to hang out in the middle of like South America, Costa Rica with, you know? Or they end up hating each other, or they end up romantically involved. Like, that's really your only options. Sure.
Yeah, where's the romance in these movies? Come on.
Well, actually, I think with Red, that is a very, very good point. Where is the romance? Fair. Let's get into our first movie. Now, in this season's tradition of wonderful bitchity snippets from one Mr. Ebert, here he opens his 2-star review with, "If the name Ernest Borgnine sounds familiar, here's the movie for you." Now, I don't actually agree with how much Raj despised this movie. I think it's got some solid moments. But then again, I am someone who actively discusses Ernest Borgnine in my day-to-day conversations. Now, regardless of the frankly brutal reviews, Vanity Fair called it the most disappointing movie of the year. It made a lot of money, enough to get a sequel. It's also an entry into the graphic novel to screen adaptation boom of the 2000s that we haven't really gotten into yet. Petula, do you think this translated from graphic novel to screen well?
Well, I didn't read the graphic novel for this one. I was considering it, but I find when I'm going to talk about a movie, then I end up often favoring the written, whether it's book or graphic novel. Mm-hmm. So similar to Old Guard, when I saw it was coming out and I hadn't read the comic yet, I waited for the movie and then read the comic. So for this one, didn't even read the comic first. Yeah.
Totally fair. We want to give people a very, very brief plot summary on this one, please.
In a now heartbreakingly meta performance, Bruce Willis as the agent who's been told he's too old, but described as the best to ever do it. And what he does isn't very nice. So think Wolverine, but former CIA agent. And he tears up his pension checks every month just to call a girl on the phone. Moving on from his entry as the saddest, loneliest guy who gets up to do sit-ups in his basement every day, we see that for some reason, despite the fact that he's living a quiet life, somebody's decided to put out a kill notice on him. And the movie proceeds to be a travel by map series of adventures intercut with beautiful postcard graphic work. Whoever did the graphics on the little postcards, you know, it shouts to you.
Yeah.
I don't know if you got the recognition you deserved back then. As Bruce Willis goes and meets up with his old friends, including somebody to look up identities based on fingertips he's cut off and brought over in a bag, played by Morgan Freeman, John Malkovich as basically John Malkovich, Helen Mirren, also the best to ever do it and still giving a lot. Mary Louise Parker, as we mentioned before, Brian Cox as Helen Mirren's ex, and Carl Urban being his best. Carl Urban also giving us a little bit of that, the young guy who can see his future and doesn't kind of want to deal with it yet. TLDR, shenanigans ensue. Old people manage to magically evade capture and murder multiple times, except for Morgan Freeman's character. It's okay. They kill the black guy first because he's got a terminal disease, and everything wraps up nicely. And in a refreshing change of pace, instead of the bad actors being stereotypes of people based outside North America, it's that the government was evil all along.
Yeah.
That was really good. True. Thank you, Petula. I'm glad that you brought up the Morgan Freeman thing, because even at the time, we had Chinnarive Du on the show earlier this season, and she talks about the sacrificial Negro, and 100% that's what this is. And even Roger Ebert calls out of being like, so of course Morgan Freeman dies, but it's okay that he dies because he's sacrificing himself for everybody else and he's okay with that. So like, even then it's not cool. And he quotes Morgan Freeman saying that he really likes being the villain in movies because at least he gets to make it to the end. And it's like, oh, Morgan, I'm sorry, bud. Oh,
yeah. Unless they let him narrate.
Very rough for somebody with us.
Exactly. Yeah, you know what? True. Maybe I would have. Yeah. Maybe this movie would have just been that little bit better had it all like been in his head all along, and then he turns into his god character from like Bruce Almighty at the end, and he's like, "That's right, I set them all in motion."
I will say I'd seen this before and I forgot that he actually dies. Like, I was like, ah, he's coming back. And then when he didn't come back, it brought a little mistiness to my eyes. Yeah, I forgot that. It's very odd, though. And it was like kind of a Morgan Freeman renaissance, too. And he's truly not in the movie that
much. He's obviously probably the least mobile. This was one of...
Yeah. He is the oldest, I think.
He's in his 80s.
Yeah, and he has had that hand injury for years. So he's not able to do that much. I wish they would just acknowledge it and then sort of have some kind of, you know, visibility of how you work around things like that. But instead, they kind of try to obscure it. They do the sort of cutaway, and then like he magically survives shenanigans, like they do with a lot of older actors now. And in a way, it's better. I don't want to see kind of the Sam Jackson's older body with younger face Captain Marvel lumbering down a hallway.
Yeah.
Yes. Yes. De-aged Robert De Niro pretending to be 20 years old.
We're literally talking about Tron Legacy next episode in the very last episode. And the de-ageification of Jeff Bridges is one that people defend because it's like he's in the Tron world, so he's digital. And it's like, no, it's just bad. Like, we need to be all clear. This just does not work and it's weird.
Yeah. I like that they planned their sort of final attack, hurting the president into their desired choke point in a way that it allowed all of them to sort of just shamble around what was obviously the Royal York here in Toronto.
Doesn't even try to hide being like the most Toronto movie that ever did.
Brian Cox taking the elevator, slowly walking out and then walking back in. It's like, yes, embrace the fact that you have older characters. Like, not everyone's Liam Neeson, not everyone's Tom Cruise. Like, let them walk.
Yes, let them walk. Yeah. Thank you, Petula.
I know 100%. I've heard Samuel L. Jackson say that he does not run in films anymore. And for about 10 years, he's like, no running. And that's like, because he's like, people think it's badass, but I just don't want to run anymore. I'm an old man.
Well, the budget on this was $60 million. And for an action film, like especially a 2010 action film, as we've mentioned previously, this is the year of the franchise. Harry Potter is winding up. Percy Jackson's going, like everything's happening. Mm-hmm. This budget is almost entirely assigned to the actors. Like, it was just them throwing money to make sure we could get the people that they wanted to get. Do you think that money was well spent? And were these all of the actors that should be there? And did people come to see these actors?
I think so. I mean, I know that one thing that's worth bringing up, because now she's kind of, it seems normal, is it was very, very unusual to have Helen Mirren at the time. Not that she didn't do action. She's obviously in White Knights and stuff in the 80s. Yeah, I think that she was kind of a weird one. Brian Cox, probably also a little unusual. Brian Cox is also weirdly, he's a guy that looks older than he is. I think he was only in his 40s in this movie. Yeah, but some of it works really well. I think Malkovich like you say, is amazing. Just having the time of his life. I think I can understand why people don't love the Mary Louise Parker character, but I think she's quite funny. I think she does quite good pulling off the weirdness of the role.
I like the fact that she's only 16 years younger than Bruce Willis, so it's not like a bananas age difference.
It's not wild.
No, it's perfectly reasonable.
No, and she does make fun of him. She's like, "You are old. I expected you to have hair."
You are also on the phone with a pensioner, though, Mary Louise Parker. So, like, adjust your expectations.
It's true. It's
here.
True. Yeah.
Is that my bag?
Yeah.
You packed it?
Yes.
Did you vacuum?
A little, yeah. It was messy.
Yeah, I do like that everyone's kind of willing to poke fun at themselves in a way that's pretty charming. But yeah, I think ultimately it's obviously probably just sold as kind of a Bruce Willis movie, but he's working harder than he had for a while. I think that this is right after Cop.
This is the same time. Literally the same time.
Yeah, would famously his most phoned in movie of all time.
Yeah, so, he was spending a lot of time in Toronto around then. It was a weird period where I would occasionally just spot Bruce Willis ambling around Toronto, and I felt safer.
Like,
wow.
Felt
like, if something happens,
if there's ducks to crawl through, this is the man who has the experience, and he will do it.
We're all right. Like, Bruce Willis is here. Some sort of international event happens. I think Toronto's okay right now. There was like a smooth 3 or 4 summers where you just like could not see Bruce Willis somewhere.
Do you feel the same way about Schwarzenegger being seen riding around on his bike with no helmet in downtown Toronto? No.
I think I would feel worried. Like, I would think that I was having a fit or something if I saw Arnold Schwarzenegger drive by on a bicycle.
Well, but Petula, what do you think? What do you think of the draw of this? And if you saw this in 2010, was that a draw for you?
Any Bruce Willis movie was a draw for me back then. Still, I think I was hard in the paint, even for some of the not great ones. And it is that ability that he has to just sort of silently harumph.
Yes.
It's the comedic timing in that he's doing not a lot. And again, now we're all probably going back and trying to figure out what year maybe some of his issues were affecting his performances more. But I feel like here it was probably the beginning of him just realizing I'm getting older. So he was still like sort of the young person out of the crew of old people, but he was at least acknowledging aches and pains in a way that we hadn't really seen his character do on screen, unless it was third act and the white tank had turned dirt brown and the feet were full of glass.
Yeah.
Like, he was giving walking on broken glass in the morning, taking his meds in act one versus taking many beatings and fights to get there. So I liked that. I like seeing Helen Mirren, I think, figured out early what a lot of actresses, maybe it took them a little longer to discern, hey, I might get something to do besides being someone's mother or grandmother if I, you know, get into some of these weird action movies or comic book movies instead of always trying to look for, you know, period work in a corset. Also, she's probably a lot more comfortable than she was in her Catherine the Great get up or something. Yeah,
totally. Well, all the interviews at the time talk about, oh my God, we got the queen, because she was coming right off of that, right?
Yeah.
But apparently, like, a lot of the stuff when the director was watching it, he actually wanted to cut out all of her action scenes, including her firing the machine guns, that plot line with her and
Brian Cox about
the romance plot line. That was all going to be cut. So it was meant to be stunt casting and giving her nothing to do. And Bruce Willis was like, do you have any idea how sexy this woman is when she fires a weapon and people are going to come in? And that was what a lot of the reviews said, is like, she is crazy sexy in this movie, which she is.
When Brian Cox scoops her up in his arms, I believe the term from another show that kind of reminds me of this in a way, Archer, sploosh. It was just like, I'm loving these people of an age above 40 looking like they might go home and, you know, celebrate accordingly after a big win like this. I mean, her injury is not a great place for that, but, you know, I'm sure after they staunch the blood flow, she'll be fine.
You know what? She gets up and moves pretty easily the next day, so I'm sure she's fine. She's probably got a lot of scar tissue in various places in her body, so that bullet probably didn't lodge too far.
Yeah. And then our real bad guy is ending up being Richard Dreyfuss and Julie McMahon. I'm like, how Mr. Holland and Nip Tuck, like, I wasn't expecting it at the time. I'd legit forgotten. So watching it again now, it was, who did the casting? And to your point, yes, obviously, all the money is in casting. It wasn't in sets or any kind of other CG work. It was, I mean, there was some good, I'd say, if anything, the stunt team probably had more to do in protecting the actors than, you know, making it look super crazy. Even the roll down the hill that Mary Louise does, that doesn't look like fun. I don't know if it was her stunt person or her, but
no.
That was like quite a tumble. That was a real like Laura Ingalls kind of situation. So, you know, all in all, like I can see where the money was spent. I like that they, you know, just acknowledged, let's make it more funny than action, but let's make the action really sparse and precise and well-planned. It was easy to follow these scenes.
Yeah.
A lot of stuff's happening in daytime. This isn't a lot of like creeping in from the shadow stuff. This is how probably older people would operate. Like, let's come up with a brazen plan that just allows us to walk in the front door versus climbing up the side of a building. It was probably one of the most plausible of any Bruce Willis film ever. The only scene that really was like, really, sir, really, was the hand-to-hand in the office with Carl Urban. However, he came in, had the element of surprise, and also fought really dirty when he flips up that table and then like punches through it. Oh my God. So
it's
good.
A great scene.
Bruce Willis actually apparently did smack him. Like he went a little harder than Carl Urban was ready for what was happening. And Carl Urban had to be like, whoa, we got to stop. This is too much.
And I saw Bruce Willis say that that is the most elaborate fight scene he's ever done on film. I said that that's like the hardest fight he ever did, which is cool. Yeah. And you know what? It's worth saying, I think, for both of these movies that, the way you're saying that it's like comprehensively shot and laid out, it's wild how much we've lost that in the intervening 10 years. Like both of these films feel refreshingly shot and like they're not cutting away from much action. Like the fight scenes, there's like two or three cuts, you know, it's kind of sad actually how much both of these were like,
what's interesting to me is that these people aren't necessarily good people either. And we're still cheering for them. Whereas I feel like now we don't do that. Someone has to be like, they can be like, you know, a little bit of a bad boy with a wink, but like you don't have reprehensible people as the heroes anymore in this scale of film.
Yeah, I think that's a Hollywood thing, because when you were talking, I know you'd prepped us a bit about the graphic novel and that's very much like you're coming to call of like, you made me this and stuff, you know, kind of the classic hitman. But there's something about Hollywood. Hollywood loves they love a charming hitman assassin. They like them to get away with it. I don't know. It's not the same thing. But if you read a book or something and somebody's, you know, like a Helen Mirren, she's an assassin. She's not even a spy.
The second movie opens with her dissolving a body in a bathtub. Like, you know who these people are.
Well, so I don't know. But it is weird because you do, you just write it off. But I feel like I'm so used to that in like, you know, Gross Point Blank or whatever. You're just, you like a hitman.
Don't we all? Don't we all love a hitman? So I want to get into the graphic novel and the difference here just for a second. And so this is, of course, as we mentioned, the golden age of the graphic novel. We talked about Kick-Ass earlier this season and how that film was very much shot simultaneously with the graphic novel coming out and then the movie coming out here. This was a graphic novel that had been bouncing around for a long time, and it came through the DC channels. And Marvel movies were already going. We're the same year as Iron Man 2 right now, and Mickey Rourke making his his kind of third resurgence, which we will be discussing in our next film. Sure. But the book is written by Warren Ellis and illustrated by Cully Hamner. We're going to put a pin in Warren Ellis because a lot of terrible things have since been revealed about him, and he is not a nice man. So we're just going to put that one to the side. However, the book is actually about the Bruce Willis character who is kind of getting attacked for no reason, in that the head of the CIA has now decided that he needs to remove any trace of any wrongdoing that the Americans ever did, and that Bruce Willis and his Bruce Willis's character committed these like horrible, horrible war crimes in South America that in the movie the vice president is accused of doing. So Bruce Willis actually did this. And so they're trying to take out Bruce Willis. So it is like a revenge plot of like, if you're not going to leave me in peace, I'm going to take you guys out. And someone described it as like this bitter, sardonic, libertarian take on like the American population written by a guy from the UK. It's really brutal and really vicious. None of these characters really exist. It's not an ensemble piece. It's very much like for one person. So to take this, or to take that graphic novel and turn it into this like fun romp with all of these people that you have come up with and you love, like you've seen them in movies for years, is such a weird turn. And then on top of that, to decide to make it PG-13 instead of R is just like, what was DC trying to do to be able to compete with Marvel? Because Marvel is very much a PG-13 kind of world, right?
Well, I'll say that the Losers you mentioned is also a DC comic that you mentioned earlier, the ensemble. But yeah, I think, I mean, PG instead of R is just classic Hollywood. You want more people to watch it. And R-rated action had been kind of out for a bit. But yeah, I just think they just wanted to make more of a Hollywood popular movie, to be honest. That's what it seems like.
Any change of comic book IP to make it more mass appeal, it's always the money. It's not. I don't think I've ever heard of it ever being an artistic or story choice. So,
yeah.
I mean, sometimes they dial things, I'm not even saying down, but sideways now, just because some of the material in the original comic book is so much darker. It's almost easier to get away with stuff in comic books, especially if you're adapting older material. Mm-hmm. So if you think of things like The Boys, like season one, even I think Starlight had a hard time in the show. The comic book is anyway.
Yes. I know that's a classic one where people are like, if you like the show, don't read the comic.
So I feel like there's always those changes that they make. Just always there's a blanket less sexuality of any kind, just because you can only show more violence as long as you don't show blood or exit wounds, like the holes. You can show blood on the back of like a skirt, but you can't show, you know, some of the stuff that we're going to be talking about in the next movie.
No sex, no fucks. Can't happen.
So, or if there is any kind of amorous interaction, I think it's like a back then I think they had still like a 2-pump limit. I think if you got to like an extra thrust, it's game over. Wow, talk about a whole generation that's taught to be very unsatisfied. Tangent. I am so sorry.
But that's something I noticed as well here too, is that the
this should be a hornier film. Totally too.
Well, the Mary Louise Parker character and the Bruce Willis character, even though they are clear they are attracted to each other, they would like to be together, they hug, but it's not an intimate hug, and there's no kissing, which I was like, that's weird. I wonder why.
I wonder if maybe they tried it and it didn't work. Because, I mean, it is an odd situation where she is resistant. You know, it's that kind of classic trope.
She's a hostage for all intents and purposes.
Yeah, she's a hostage. So I think that they maybe kind of soften it to be like, they'll see where this goes.
Yeah, I like that there was some distance in the, like, back of the car credits kiss from her being restrained and taped up. And so that she didn't immediately want to.
That's a bit, you know, the bad stuff from the 80s where it's like kidnapping is
it
good.
It did seem like when they got into the creation of this, any of the interviews I was reading in the making of, they were saying that the plot was a bit of a mess because they were adapting it so all over the place and trying to get the rating, but making sure that all of these people got screen time and then adding all these characters. Like the Richard Dreyfuss thing was added. It was supposed to be a post-credit scene. And then they were like, oh, no, this actually has to be the end of the movie because that's the only thing that makes sense. Like, I'm not entirely sure where they had ended it, but apparently it was just like a mess of plot points. And you were just watching people do cool, weird stuff that you love.
Sure. But I think it works. And I will, without revealing much proprietary information, I know this is still a very popular film among our viewers. So, like, I think it's held up the test of time, oddly, considering it's, like you say, not very kindly reviewed. Though it was nominated for a Golden Globe, I saw, which is kind of wild for an action movie. Yeah, that doesn't mean
much. Well, this is the same year we talked about it in Burlesque. This is the year where it was kind of revealed as being shenanigans, because that's what Burlesque got nominated for, and The Tourist got nominated for multiple Golden Globes because they gave them a free Cher concert.
I argue Burlesque deserves more love than The Tourist deserves less, but not this episode.
Oh, yes. The Tourist. No one's going to argue for The Tourist. Don't worry.
I also think the change that they made that's really different and weird to me is that, so in the film, RED is an acronym and it stands for Retired Extremely Dangerous, which I'm like, okay, that's kind of cute. But the book, it just means he's deactivated. Like, it's red versus green. But I love how far they took this acronym. So, like, in the soundtrack, all 20 cues on it, there's Christoph Beck, of course, they're all titled RED, but they are like Rotating Enforcement Device. Regular easygoing dudes rehash every detail. So they made sure everything had R-E-D in the titles of them. And then, of course, we love our weird retitling of movies in other countries. And in Bulgaria, this movie was distributed under BSP, which, my apologies for my Bulgarian pronunciation, of Bezni Strazni Pensi, which means Furious Frightful Pensioners, but also is the abbreviation of the Bulgarian Socialist Party, which old people would vote for. So it's kind of doing double duty there. I'm like, that's delightful. I feel like we need an FFS coming up. Furious Frightful Pensioners.
Under all the great casting, I almost forgot to mention Mrs. Kim from Gilmore Girls. Emily Kuroda is in here.
One of the only times I've seen her in a thing, I think, too. What a throw off to me. Yeah. Wow. Yeah. I loved
so
it.
I felt so safe when I saw her. I was like, okay, so everyone's just going to be amazing. Like, even somebody who shows up for 1 minute. Yeah.
So let's get back into Helen Mirren just for a moment here. I love that she went to various, all the Comic-Cons and all that, and was promoting the film wearing Harvey Bekar shirts, because she was trying to promote the very idea of the graphic novel as an art form. Do we feel like in 2010 that needed to happen? Like, that we weren't totally aware that it was kind of a thing unto itself? Like, I think Sin City is like 2007. Ghost World is 2001.
Oh, yeah. No, I think they're into it. If you know, I mean, I don't know how much I've trumped on it so far, but after the 2008 recession, Hollywood got so invested in intellectual property that I think that, there was no safe graphic. I don't think you can make a graphic novel these days without some producer sniffing around. But I think it's good. And if she's bringing viewership to American Splendor and the very great American Splendor movie, why not?
She's just trying to elevate it. So I don't think it's that it needed for the audience at Comic-Con that kind of visibility. I think she's aware of who she is and that she spans a pretty broad base of fans across the world, even, and ages and gender. So for her to say to maybe women her age that maybe have only seen her things on, you know, numbers 1 through 4 of the BBC, hey, you might want to check some of these out. Maybe not all of them, but some of these have good stories. It's just they're told, you know, with, you know, images and color and a little less text.
As an adaptation of a graphic novel, we're talking about Kick-Ass, like I mentioned earlier in the season, and that very much is taking like stills of comic books. It has a very like comic booky sort of feel. Here, the action, you see a little bit of that, but I think this is more cinematic.
It's had some fun camera moves and stuff that I figured were comic book related. I don't know, like I liked the bullets on the frying pan early on. That seemed very visual. In its own way, this guy was coming out. The director Robert Schwenke, who's like, who knows? He's coming out Flight Plan, which I feel like was a very visually weird movie. Lots of zooming around, and I don't know. I without having read the graphic novel, I don't know what maybe are the visuals, but it was.
I think in some of the production design and a lot of what they did with Morgan Freeman's character. Like, he had the tracksuit when he was at the home in Louisiana. And then he had this sort of garish, like, I'm a dictator, like dictator, but make it fancy. So his character had a lot of the kind of looks that I would expect to see in a panel where you have enough maybe visual difference, but you want maybe one or two characters to really pop in a scene. Same with Carl Urban, just basically being menacing guy in a suit. You know, so you would see that kind of character often, like in profile and shadow and kind of, you know, observing and just advancing. The him sliding down the back window of the car when he's chasing them away from the Royal York, that sort of face slide, whether or not it was in the graphic novel, that a couple of those shots, I was like, this is kind of giving comic book, but it wasn't really. I think the Losers tried harder, but arguably that perhaps affected some of their other attempts at cohesion.
All right, well, let's get into our second movie, which is all about the action and less about the comedy. It's The Expendables, and that's coming up after the break. There are few actors of a certain vintage who know their audiences as well as Sylvester Stallone. While other actors have achieved longevity by constantly reinventing themselves for new audiences, think someone like John Travolta, Stallone has found a way to repackage the same thing over and over again in ways that not only retain his audience that was cultivated in the 70s, but invites new viewers for bigger explosions, more brutal kills, and that wafting miasma of machismo that he does so well. The Expendables is the perfect example of how savvy Stallone is, including one moment that had no explosions that I'm sure many in the crowd went bananas over. Was this worth expending your time? Cam, what do you think?
Yeah, you know what? I remember at the time being somewhat disappointed by this film, but I think in retrospect, like we were saying, it's well filmed, it's kind of silly, it's fun action. I'm not mad at it, really. I don't know. It's about what you would expect. It's just a typical kind of mercenaries tasked with doing a thing. In this case, it's Sylvester Stallone is leading these mercenaries. It's the main mercenaries are Sylvester Stallone, Jason Statham, Jet Li, and Dolph Lundgren. You start off with a botched caper where Lundgren is kicked off the team. And then they are eventually sent to this South American made-up nation to do they kind of shady stuff. They don't really know what they're doing. They realize eventually that they are sent by a CIA agent to essentially assassinate a rogue CIA agent. And then they're back and forth struggling with whether, you know, what's right, what do you do, what's good. And then they're inspired on the way by Sandra, a revolutionary who is captured by the bad guys, but is, yeah, maybe she's more passionate than they are, and what is it all for? But of course all that doesn't really matter. It's mostly about cracking jokes. And you know, Dolph gets hired by the baddies. They also have Terry Crews.
Yeah, Steve Austin is there. This for me is like textbook why Stallone is a fucking genius. Like, I'm sorry, this man is insane. Like, not only did he bring back all of these people that like people would be totally cheering to see, but like he's got wrestlers in there. He's got MMA fighters. Mm-hmm. He's got Terry Crews, who was an NFL star. And this is before Brooklyn Nine-Nine, when like you could really see how funny and incredible actor he is.
Oh, yeah. This was Terry Crews basically being from the Old Spice.
Which, may I please point people towards the Comic-Con announcement of this, the panel that he did on it, because Terry Crews is announced first to come out on this panel, and he comes out in full, like, wrestling form. He jumps on the table, he rips his shirt off, he does the Beck thing where he makes some dance, and then he sits down, and then Steve Austin just comes out and, like, gently shakes his hand and sits down, and I'm like, Steve Austin, come on, you know how to do that, the entrances. But, like, it's nuts how he's like, how do I bring in all of these different people that will bring an audience that people will really freak out about from this world? Like, it's brilliant.
Yeah. And I think he's also purposefully kind of playing in the direct to video action realm, which had been blowing up. People like Isaac Florentine working with Jean-Claude Van Damme and Dolph Lundgren. Though, yeah, like, it's interesting. Dolph Lundgren, this is his first theatrical film since Johnny Mnemonic. which is wild to think of. So he's rehabilitating some people. I think even Jet Li had kind of fallen by the wayside in mainstream English language.
But he had such a huge tie to Jason Statham because he was in two movies with Jason Statham. So that would have brought him in.
Yeah. Yeah. So there's these guys who are like Jason Statham also mostly at the time was working in foreign, like European action movies. Yeah. So it's just this kind of interesting mix to rehabilitate his own career. Let's be honest. I mean, he'd had John Rambo. He'd had Rocky Balboa. But neither of those were stellar. Yeah.
I feel like Sylvester Stallone is a lot smarter. He's one of those people, just because of his affect and sort of his speech patterns, similar to Keanu Reeves, sort of gets thought of a certain way. But, you know, he writes and directs. Like, he's a filmmaker, and he knows about the business, and he thinks in a very tactical way. This movie, watching it now, very much felt like he kind of maybe studied what was going well in a franchise like Fast and Furious or Point Break with cars, as I still passive aggressively call it, and thought, let's do that, but make it older. So, because some of the things that have helped that franchise continue to grow its global reach and box office, regardless of the quality of the actual storytelling, as you go, you know, past the Brian era, it was really the diversity, and they didn't really talk about it then, but I feel like he noticed that. So having more than just a couple of scenes for someone like a Terry Crews or Jet Li, I think helps. What's less helpful is some of the generic bad guy stuff that was oof back then, but watching it now is just like, how about just pick one country to dunk on, like, or one to...
The whole opening with the Somali pirates is like, oh boy, oh boy.
Oh my God, that was... Yeah, and poor David Zayas. It's just... Yeah.
I mean, that's really all you can
say. I mean, he's like, you know, our cuddly Tio from Dexter. He's not this guy. Like, it was...
Yeah.
It was tough. It was tough. Yeah.
He's kind of the good actor too. Like you assume you're bringing him in for like the heat, and he doesn't really get much to do. Yeah, it's a that aspect is weird. I mean, I guess it's like trying to be an '80s throwback, but that is where. And I also think some of the women stuff is a little cringe. The Charisma Carpenter stuff, and also Sandra is kind of interesting because she's a revolutionary and she gets waterboarded, and she is much more passionate and kind of inspires them, but she doesn't get to kill anybody. She's mostly just in distress. Now,
Cam,
sucks.
I know you just watched Rambo 2, like I just watched Rambo 2 for the TV series, and the parallels between these two movies is freaking wild to me. Here's the female revolutionary that he pairs up with who's going to die and do that, like it's, or she gets captured in this one, but it's the same thing. So that has to inspire him to do whatever. They're in the jungle. Here's that, like the bad guy set up in the turncoats. Like it's almost the same movie. It's wild how close they are.
Yeah. And I mean, being expendable is the whole Rambo 2 thing. So it's like it's all inspired by Rambo 2. It's weird. But at the same time, I would almost say that as bad as the woman in Rambo 2 is real rough. But she gets to shoot guys. She's like a cool action star, at least. Yeah, I don't know. And yeah, the Charisma Carpenter stuff is real brutal. Every time it's not comedy. Like, I do think you, in our research, it's revealed that it kind of went back and forth between comedy and action. And he wanted it to be more action, but I think weirdly stuff like the Jet Li comedy is very good. Like I think that a lot of the silly comedy and just them busting each other's balls is like what I would prefer to any of the serious stuff.
My life is difficult. I need more money.
Why is that?
I work harder than the rest.
No, you don't.
Yes, I do. Because they're taller. Mm-hmm. Everything is harder for me. Why I get hurt? The only is bigger. Because I'm smaller. Mm. When I travel, I need to go farther.
I know, because you're smaller, right?
Yes.
Petula, you mentioned that you wanted to, that what you like out of these movies is watching the background people do things together who aren't the leads. What did that work for you here? Did you like the antics between everybody? And if so, what did you like?
I'd say not as much because some of those people that I got really excited to see, like a Christopher Carpenter, who we know is great and can do comedy and not just be decorative. I was so excited to see her at the beginning, and then it was just, oh, oh, it's going to be like that. Same with David Zayas and like even Eric Roberts. I was hoping for a little more for him to do. So I don't think it's the fault of any of the actors. I think it was very much, you know, it's Sly and his friends and everybody else is sort of punch out the paper doll outfit and put it on and we're going to move around you. So yeah, to your point, some of the best like bro down in the background stuff was involving Jet Li where, you know, he jumps to the car and like, I'm going to come with you. I have to work harder because I'm shorter, you know, even like the little moment in the fight where he notices it's like low clearance and uses that to fight Dolph Lundgren's character. So I would say that they didn't maybe they did a good job of casting some of those smaller roles, but the most that any of them got to do was be smacked on the butt. Mickey Rourke, even I was like, okay, so this is that weird era where, okay, we've already had the beginning of the Mickey Rourke Renaissance. 2010 was around Wrestler time.
2005 is
after 2005 the wrestler,
and that was supposed to bring him back, but he was still a weirdo that nobody wanted to shoot with. And so this is the same year as Iron Man 2, and Iron Man 2 was Jon Favreau. And it feels like, I mean, Mickey Rourke has a really big supportive network of people that really like him, that obviously he's a fun hang, so they want him to do well. So they threw him Iron Man 2, and but it's also Eric Roberts at this point needed a big career revival because he'd had a lot of really bad press and, you know, done a lot of really terrible things. And this is him bringing his buddy back for that as well. Yeah. So he's giving a lot of these people second and third chances.
I think Eric Roberts falls in that direct to video. Like some of these guys are actually pretty big. I know one person who shows up and weirdly gets underutilized is Gary Daniels, who's one of the goons, the not Stone Cold Steve Austin goon that is British. He's kind of one of the best 80s British martial artists that had a lot of 90s direct to video stuff. I kind of was waiting for him to fight Jet Li, but it never came to pass. But yeah, I think that Eric Roberts, like the weird thing is you're like, Eric Roberts needed a win, but Eric Roberts also produces 90 direct to video movies a year. He's that kind of guy. So I don't know. It seems like he's consciously playing in it, but I also agree with you, Petula. It's weird that you would not let him off the hook. Like just take Eric Roberts' leash off and let him be like a frothing at the mouth
maybe
villain.
Why have some fun? Fun cameo moment was Bruce Willis.
Well, I mean, that's I'm sure the moment everybody freaked out is that not only do you have Willis and Stallone, you've also got Arnold Schwarzenegger walking in that moment. And all I could think about was, holy shit, how much money did they spend on just that one scene for that? Like, was this like a Salvador Dali in Jodorowsky's Dune sort of moment where it's like the most expensive thing ever? Apparently, the answer is no. It was $400,000 for Bruce Willis, which isn't a ton of money when you think about what he's used to commanding. And Schwarzenegger did it for free because he actually couldn't take any money from making movies because he was at the end of his run for being governor. So from 2005 to 2010, he couldn't and didn't take any money from acting.
Yeah, that's why I think that there's only two cameos. It's this and Around the World in 80 Days. I think he shows up in for free. But yeah, it's a weird one. But kind of delightful, and he ends up being pretty fun in the sequels, I seem to remember, because they both kind of show up legitimately for the second one. Not that I do think it's diminishing returns in my memory for these sequels.
I think Bruce Willis knew what movie he was in. I'm not sure that everyone else did. It was uneven. It could have been worse. I think I remembered it being worse. It was just...
Yeah, I definitely remembered it being worse. You're off the hook there. I expected it to be much worse than it was.
The back and forth, though, between like their garage / tattoo parlor hangout and made up country, that was a little bit of, you know, travel by map shenanigans. So that part when they were kind of laying out the decision between the initial assault and then going back, that was a little bit nonsensical.
Yeah. And I think that that's where you see, when you're seeing people like the Scott Adkins movies and the Isaac Florentine, like modern direct-to-video action movies, they would just go to that country and then it would be a cool, you know, it'd be like The Raid. Why not just make it one long action sequence? And then I think that's Stallone getting a little caught up in the 80s and getting caught up, like you said, to trying to make The Wild Bunch or trying to make some emotionally affecting movie, which may not be his strong suit.
No, but I think that's also like he feels like his audiences, because so much of it is his awareness of his audience, and that's what he makes his movie for. Like he went and when he was on the trail for this, he went and accepted an award. I'm trying to remember where, but like he made sure to thank the audience because he's like, I wouldn't be here without you guys. Like he is so very aware of how to continue to play for his fan base and what his fan base wants. And I think that's something he thinks his fan base wants, especially after Rocky, right? Because Rocky is an incredibly effective drama, which is why it won him an Oscar.
Yeah, and I mean, I guess that's why Creed is what caught him good, because it's not him. It's somebody else knowing someone outside of his sphere saying, this is what you, maybe you're good at.
I mean,
at.
maybe admit you're
an old
but
man.
But even the casting of Lundgren is also a nod to the audience, right? Because Lundgren has always been his enemy, so of course he's got to be the turncoat. I mean, in that, he refers to Lundgren as being very cooperative. So I'm like, I wonder what that means.
I've loved a little more on the production design costume side. I feel like sometimes
it's a very dark movie, isn't
very
it?
Very dark, hard to see. It was giving Long Night, Game of Thrones at some points, making it hard to follow the action. Some of the prettiest shots, the whole Terry Crews moment. There were some nice shots with him talking to people in a car, and the light would hit just perfectly. Jet Li seemed to be really good at finding the light in some very poorly constructed scenes.
Yeah.
Using his just general sort of balletic movement in those cheekbones to just find like a slice of light where it didn't exist. But it was harder than in the made up country. They kind of just dressed all of the locals like house elves. Like,
yes, very true.
Yeah, but I understand they needed all the money for all of the action stars.
All the boys. I know one thing to bring up along those lines. I remember that a big thing that people hated with this movie was it was one of the big ones to have CGI blood. Because this is a pretty gory, bloody explosion movie, but I know that this was kind of the start of everyone being like, we're all pretty used to it now, I think, and it doesn't look so bad, really, push come to shove, but I remember a lot of people just wishing that there was more practical explosions.
But here's what's so wild about it, is that there is. Multiple people were injured on set, including Stallone, who had to have several surgeries because of his injuries because of this film. Steve Austin almost got his leg blown off because he was too near one of the explosions, and he had a bag in his hand, which, thank God, took most of the blow, and he didn't lose his leg. The woman who's playing the revolutionary, she's actually being waterboarded in that scene. Like, she insisted on doing her own stunt, which I'm like, they have other people to do that. How did insurance let you do that? That's nuts. Yeah, it's interesting to hear that. And part of it was that they, Rambo 2, the new Rambo 2, not the old Rambo 2, if you will, that was seriously derided in the media for being like almost a splatter film, like grotesquely over-the-top violent. Sure. So when they went to do this movie, they were like, well, first they started with like the satire, and then they were like, well, no, it's an action film. It's making a proper action film. But they cut two versions of it. They cut a hard R and they cut a PG-13, and they tested both, and the hard R did better. So it's really interesting of like what people want out of what movie. It's like, because Rambo, you would think, I want all the violence, you know?
Yeah, though I remember that one being quite over the top. And especially even for Rambo, you know, Rambo, as much as he shoots everybody and slices himself, it's kind of a James Bond. You know, they just fall over.
I can see that. There's something you brought up earlier, Petula, about it's watching Bruce Willis get hurt. It's kind of the same thing for Stallone, and it's these classic action stars that you don't really see in modern action stars, where like they're always pretty, and like even though they get hit, it never actually seems like they're hurt. Whereas these like 80s action stars, yeah, they get hurt. So you feel that pain more. It's more believable.
Oh yeah, well they all looked like they were struggling, except for Statham. You can see like kind of the grunts and groans, even getting in and out of vehicles. And him getting into the plane at the end, there's a lot of, oh, this is taking something out of your body. Like that I did appreciate. I don't know how much of that was actual performance and how much was just time and what happened to them on this film.
Well, yeah, that, and I mean, they've also done so many terrible things to their body over the course of their careers that I'm sure their bodies are not like our bodies. It's all the scar tissue, right?
Yeah. For all we know, perfect. He really was letting Mickey Rourke tattoo him and just couldn't even feel anything. Yeah.
All right. And on that note, I am ending this episode. Hopefully this episode didn't take too much out of you, Petula. Thank you so much for being here.
I feel okay. I don't think I'm going to crawl through any ducks anytime soon.
Oh, good. Can you tell people how they can find you and your work?
At inatif.com, on Twitter at obesacantavit, obesacantavit, and on Back Issue Bloodbath.
Fantastic. Thank you so much. Cameron Maitland, thank you once again for joining us.
Hey, thank you for having me. And yeah, like I say, lots of great action movies out there. If you dig through the bin, we're in a real renaissance.
Yeah, yeah. I'm all about the VOD. And you can find many of them on Hollywood Suite. Thank you very much. And you can join us in 2 weeks for our final episode of season 4. Alicia Fletcher and Cameron Maitland join me as we look at 2010 reboots. It's Predators and Tron Legacy. That's coming up in 2 weeks. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast from Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies and the series that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free. Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen. On 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cameron Maitland. Today's episode featured Cam Maitland and Petula Neal as guests. Supervising producer is Emily Gagne. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you in a couple weeks.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.